Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It's Friday, February 11th, 2022. Today, as we do each week, we check in with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, joins me with his reporting and editorial analysis. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
We start this week with a tribute to Jason Epstein, who died on February 4th at the age of 93, a legendary Random House editor. Epstein was credited by some with inventing the trade paperback. He was known not only for his passion for books as an editor, but also for his passion for the business of books.
Yeah, I think acknowledging Jason Epstein's passing really is the place to start because, frankly, the publishing industry this week really did say goodbye to a legend, you know, a giant who, as in if you read our open on the PW site, really did combine a deep passion for literature with a very shrewd business mind. Epstein began his career at Doubleday before joining Random House in 1958. And, you know, I can't help but think back about what Random House was back then in 1958, you know, not the juggernaut that it is now, but this, you know, truly innovative and expanding house that, you know, Epstein, frankly, became one of the architects of as it was to go forward. You know, at Random House, he edited fantastic authors like E.L. Doctorow and Norman Mailer and Philip Roth and Gore Vidal. The list goes on. And as far as innovation goes, you know, Jason Epstein was a driver there as well. You mentioned the trade paperback innovation. Well, before he joined Random House in 1952, looking for a way to make hardcover books more accessible, in other words, to sell more books, Epstein borrowed a format that had been used in British publishing, and he started America's first trade paperback publisher, Anchor Books. So, you know, I guess, no, technically he didn't invent the trade paperback, but he certainly did pretty much invent what I would call the first American trade paperback publisher in Anchor. It really did sort of open up a new market. And of course, that's not all. You know, Epstein co-founded the New York Review of Books, and he would go on to create the Library of America. And, you know, after all he had done for 50 years, in 2006, he co-founded the On Demand Books Company, which began marketing the Espresso Book Machine, which, of course, is that little machine that prints books from digital files from whatever location you're in, a bookstore. And while I think, you know, its cost and the technology sort of limited the success of the Espresso book machine, there's still some around. And I think the concept more broadly has really proven out, the idea of on-demand printing. Epstein was also an author, we should point out. He wrote a book called The Book Business, which was published in 2001, and Eating, a memoir. He was a noted gourmand, and that came out in 2009. So yeah, I wish we had time here to run down all the various remembrances of Jason Epstein, but I'm confident that a quick Google search can turn a lot of those up for our listeners, and I'll encourage them to do that. But I want to conclude with this, and that's that I just can't help but thinking about the changes that Jason Epstein saw over his career and how he managed to stay at once so focused on the mission of pursuing authors and editing and creating these great literary works, you know, a mission that really hasn't changed much over the years. And yet somehow he always managed to stay on the cutting edge and agitated and sought new solutions for marketing and selling books. You know, I just imagine if the ebook had come out when Jason Epstein was in his prime, right? What would he have done with that technology? And I think, you know, by asking that question, what I'm really asking is, who's next Jason Epstein out there, right? You know, because I do wonder who in today's highly corporate, concentrated publishing world, at least concentrated at the very highest levels, who's going to really innovate and seize the opportunities to expand the world of reading like Jason did in his day. You know, in their statement, officials praised Jason Epstein as a visionary, and he was. He truly was. And, you know, we may not see another like him for quite some time in the publishing business.
Innovation in the book business doesn't come often or easily, Andrew. An article in this week's PW about the advent of AI narration in audiobooks is a good illustration of that point. The possibility has some voice actors quite nervous.
Again, I think it's a little scary how quickly artificial intelligence is advancing, right? I think for many of us, we still tend to think that AI is a long way from being useful, you know, especially when we're, you know, stuck in some useless customer service bot chat with our bank or, you know, some other service provider or screaming representative into the phone to try to get a real human on the line. But on the other hand, a lot of people now have smart homes. And look, the evidence is everywhere. AI has arrived and it's getting better exponentially. You know, it gets better every week. And it's going to be a huge part of our future. And I think that's really being felt now in the audiobook realm, where AI narration has come a long way and fast from the early days of these robot-like disembodied voices. And already in some cases, you can't tell the difference. And as digital audio has become a major source of revenue and profit, that really has voice actors sort of worried out there. And, you know, some players see that, you know, as a potential to cut voice actors out of the loop and possibly even juice profits further for the publishers.
So how likely is that to happen?
Well, I think if I'm being honest, you know, it's a near certainty to some degrees. In some form and in some way, it's going to happen. It's just plain economics. You know, if you're a publisher and you can create an audio version for pennies instead of dollars, why wouldn't you, right? But I don't think it's going to happen completely or, you know, immediately. For one, with nonfiction books especially, authors want to narrate their own books. So there's that. And a lot of voice actors out there, of course, you know, as an audiobook fan myself, are remarkably talented. And I don't believe they can ever be replaced by a machine. I could be wrong about that, but I really do believe that. But at the same time, you know, there's this great proliferation. You know, we have all these titles out there where the economics of creating an audio work just don't look great. But suddenly, if you can use AI to create an audiobook edition of something cheaply, you know, a book that reads itself to you more or less rather than a performance, well, then why not do it? You know, but I very much agree with the article, and you can check it out on the PW site now, that this is an issue that goes beyond dollars and cents, right? As Emily Lawrence, who's the co-founder of the Professional Audiobook Narrators Association, points out, there's an entire ecosystem of people who really rely on audiobooks for their livelihood. You know, people who direct them and edit them and, you know, check audiobook narration for word perfection against the manuscript. And in this age of deep fakes, there's ethical issues out there too. You think it's easy to pirate a book? Well, consider how easy it is to actually pirate and maybe misappropriate someone's voice. You know, you just get some recordings of famous actors and use your computer to sort of match it to perfection. It can be done. So look, there's plenty more to discuss. And you know, this is a very well done article by my colleague Shannon Mon at PW. But I'm going to cut myself off here because the piece, it really is one of those issues I think that has implications for right now, but also well into the future. So I think it's important that we have this conversation now and start it right now so that the stakeholders can get some ground rules and some ethical considerations baked in before the technology hits that, you know, let's move fast and break things moment.
And a story that you've been following fairly closely, Andrew, the Maryland Library ebook law had its day in court on February 7th. You were listening as well to the arguments as lawyers for the state of Maryland and the Association of American Publishers squared off. You filed an in-depth report on the day on the PW website. So first, tell us about the hearing. And bear in mind, of course, that we don't yet have a ruling as of this recording, though we could have one at any moment.
Yeah, so I guess the place to start was that there really were no surprises from either party in terms of their oral arguments. They largely stuck to their briefs, which we've talked about on the show, and you can read about on the PW site. The Association of American Publishers, their attorney Scott Zebrack, reiterated the AAP's position that Maryland's library ebook law is clearly preempted by the Federal Copyright Act, telling the court that Maryland was seeking to enact what he called a quote, Shadow Copyright Act. And for the state of Maryland, Assistant Attorney General Sean Fitzgerald told the court that the state's ebook law was a library protection law and that they need the law because, you know, it basically comes down to preserving balance. Fitzgerald said that Congress had carefully crafted the Copyright Act to balance a creator's right to negotiate a fair price with the public's need to access the works. But that balance can't be maintained, Fitzgerald told the court, if publishers can arbitrarily deny licenses to public libraries or license them only on what he called demonstrably unfair terms. And after those brief opening statements, federal judge Deborah Boardman, who's a recent Biden appointee who only took the bench, I believe, last March, launched in with her questions in what would turn out to be a 3-hour hearing. And that was a surprise because this, to me, I thought was a pretty simple, straightforward case about whether the AAP should be granted a preliminary injunction blocking the Maryland law from taking effect while their, you know, copyright case moves forward. But this hearing was really all over the place in terms of the law and conversation about copyright and what the law does and about the library ebook market even. So, you know, let me back up a second too, because there's a couple of quick points we should hit, which is you know, the first of which, this hearing was really only on the AAP's motion for a preliminary injunction. So it didn't really touch on the state's motion to dismiss, though it sort of came up throughout. But this was really focused on the injunction. So the motion to dismiss is still pending. So bear that in mind. And if there was a surprise for me, too, it was this, that virtually none of the three-hour discussion went to whether there was enough of a basis here for the federal court to step in and actually block the state law, which, as we've discussed previously, was passed unanimously by the Maryland state legislature. And that, to me, was the issue I was looking forward to hearing most about, right? Because it's a big deal for the federal government to step in and block a state law. So I was very curious to hear where this case sort of fits into that legal landscape, you know, the federal government blocking a state law. And I didn't really get much at all from the hearing about that.
And you followed the proceedings online, Andrew. So were you able to get a sense of how the arguments landed on the judge's ears?
Yeah, so I point out that it usually is hard to predict how a case will go from the oral arguments. But I do think it matters a little bit more in a motions hearing like this because the judge is the one asking most of the questions, right? And I'd say that the AAP has to be very pleased with how the court approached this hearing, because the thrust of Judge Boardman's questions seemed very much to start from the AAP's position that this was first and foremost a copyright issue, and the state was on the defensive almost from the outset. So my take is certainly that the AAP got the better of the exchange and had a much more sympathetic ear from the court than the state had.
So pretty clearly then, Andrew, you have the AAP ahead on your scorecard.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm going to stand by my analysis on this podcast from last week, which is that for all the various moving parts and arguments here, you know, this motion and this case ultimately probably will very likely boil down to one very simple point. And that's whether the judge finds that this state law is so clearly, obviously preempted by federal copyright that it has to be enjoined. And the judge really did seem to start from that point. So, you know, it seems like the AAP is definitely ahead on points here. And also, I don't believe that the state did a terrific job clarifying their position as to why this shouldn't be enjoined, why it's not a copyright issue. And I'll say this, too, for Scott Zebrak, who is the AAP attorney. He was impressively disciplined in keeping the argument focused on one thing. And that's that, you know, this is the only God can make a tree. Well, only Congress can make a copyright law. That was what Mr. Zebrak came back time and time again to, that this is Congress's domain solely. On the other hand, Mr. Fitzgerald for the state of Maryland, you know, while he did tell the court that this was a consumer protection bill, he engaged with that copyright argument. And I think he missed a number of chances to sort of reinforce the state's position that this was about regulating contracts. And frankly, he found himself in the weeds really quickly a number of times, almost arguing that libraries enjoy some kind of special privilege in the Copyright Act, which of course they do in some parts, Section 108, for example. But I think what he needed to do was sort of the exact opposite of what was done here. My impression, anyway, was that the state needed to make the point that this really isn't about libraries having a special place in the Copyright Act. It's about libraries having the same rights as a consumer. So, you know, this isn't in my report online, but I'll give you one small example of where I think the AAP sort of got the upper hand in the oral argument. At one point, the court suggested that the library ebook market is a different market entirely than the consumer ebook market, you know, Amazon and the like. And that's, of course, because libraries lend their books. And Fitzgerald for the state of Maryland conceded the point. And I feel like that was a huge missed opportunity because the answer, I think, is that, you know, well, yes, publishers have set libraries up as a different market, but there's nothing in the Copyright Act that said libraries are a different kind of customer, right? They're not privileged in the market, but nor are they any different. And nothing in the Maryland Act, per se, preferences any publisher model over any other model, or nothing dictates prices or terms. The law basically only says that you can't sell to everyone else in the state and then exclude or upcharge this other class of customer, which is libraries. So the question to me, it seemed like a great opportunity for Mr. Fitzgerald to say that that question was misplaced, you know, because it doesn't matter that publishers have set up different access terms and pricing and channels for library ebooks, because that's all fine. They have the right to do that. The Maryland Act, rather, concerns itself only with whether those contract terms are fair and not discriminatory to all Marylanders, or to any Marylanders, I should say. And the publishers, having chosen to sell their works via contract, don't get the right to skirt regulation of those contracts just because the product is copyrighted. You know, this was really a chance for the state to reinforce that the question before the court isn't about whether the publishers might want to or need to or have the right to treat libraries differently in their contracts, but whether the publishers have the power to evade oversight of those contracts. Now, to be clear, I'm not saying that's a winning argument. Okay, the AAP for sure believes it isn't. They believe the copyright owner can absolutely pick and choose who to license to and who not to. But what I am saying is that that is the state's argument, for better or worse. And I feel like they missed a chance to make it there. Now, let's contrast that with Mr. Zebrak. And her first question, Judge Boardman asked about this equity of access issue. And she said, and I'll quote her here, "It does seem to me that there is inequity and unfairness in how publishers have treated public libraries." And Zebrak refused to concede the point. "Your Honor, I don't understand the starting point of the question," he replied. He went on to dispute that there is any issue at all with the library book market, which he characterized as flourishing. And he suggested that this, quote, "perceived unfairness" was, you know, due to the state relying on the word of these, you know, library advocates who were part of some anti-copyright agenda. Now, to be clear, that's a lot of spin. You know, the library ebook market has a long history of contention, which we've talked about for 10 years on this show. And this law was very clearly taken up as a direct response to Macmillan's embargo. But Zebrak deftly dispatched with Boardman's question, and I think in impressive fashion, and quickly brought the question back around to his argument, which is that Congress makes policy for copyright. You know, Congress gives copyright holders their rights. And, you know, he, on the one hand, denied there was any unfairness in the market, but then he went back and argued that, hey, even if there was, it doesn't matter because this is about Congress, Congress, Congress. And Congress gives copyright holders the right to do what they want to do, period. So this isn't about unfairness in the market to the extent that it even exists. This is about the state trying to sub in this judgment for Congress, which the AP, Mr. Zebrak, insists simply cannot do.
So the motion for a preliminary injunction is now with the court. What happens next?
So now we wait. And I don't think we're going to be waiting very long. At the end of the hearing, Judge Boardman promised a speedy decision. Now, again, the AAP has a fairly high bar to clear to win a preliminary injunction. In order to win, they have to there's this four-factor test they have to satisfy. One, they have to show a likelihood of success on the merits. Two, they have to show there will be irreparable harm without an injunction. Three, they have to win the balance of equities. And four, they have to show that an injunction would be in the public interest. And if any one of these factors tips against the AAP, the injunction has to be denied. But, you know, at the hearing, Boardman focused mostly on the irreparable harm issue. And while that issue is complicated by the fact that the law in Maryland has not yet been invoked, so there's no real harm to point to, the AAP has a very straightforward main argument here. And that's that this law is a constitutional injury because it infringes upon copyright holders' exclusive constitutionally granted rights. You know, they can't exercise their rights without running afoul of state law. Federal law trumps that. So this is a constitutional injury, and a constitutional injury, by definition, is irreparable harm. Check and mate. Now, Mr. Fitzgerald from Maryland insisted that the AAP had not met its burden on any of the four factors, and he implored Judge Boardman to deny the injunction. Granting it, he said, would just rubber stamp every publisher's decision to discriminate against libraries in the digital realm. And here's where it got interesting at the end, because Judge Boardman actually kind of strangely, I should say, pushed back on that. She said, well, isn't that a little extreme? And she pointed out that, you know, look, she's borrowed ebooks from the library. And yeah, you know, it took a long time to get the ebook and there was a lot of waiting, but libraries had access. So she suggested that wasn't really an issue. And I just remember thinking, well, okay then, because I thought it was strange to me how this response sort of encapsulated the very issue we're talking about. Because it's good to know from Judge Boardman's point of view that being a well-resourced lawyer who can afford to buy all the books she wants and can afford to wait, that she thinks the library market works for her. But what about that frontline worker with limited means or the immunocompromised reader whose only option is ebooks in the library? And that really is the essence of the equity issue the library community is pressing. And that was a great opportunity to bring it up. Fitzgerald didn't. Now, he did push back on Judge Boardman, not in the fashion that I just did, but he did take issue with the idea that the library ebook market, as Mr. Zebrak said, was flourishing based on the fact that digital lending numbers are going up, that they're booming. You know, of course, library lending is booming, Mr. Fitzgerald said, because taxpayers are footing the bill. Libraries will always do whatever they can to get access to these ebooks, but saying that libraries are accessing these products does not equate to publishers licensing them on fair terms, and that, Mr. Fitzgerald claims, is the issue here. And it also doesn't stop publishers from taking that access away in the future whenever they want to. You know, and this is such a compelling issue, he pointed out at the very end of his argument, that the Maryland General Assembly passed this act unanimously. Now, was that enough? Too little, too late? Was that an effective argument? Or is this just a fatally flawed bill from the outset because it tramples on the federal government's exclusive role in setting copyright policy? We will soon see. Unanimous or not, though, fatally flawed or not, though, the fate of this bill is now in the hands of this one federal judge. But I would say that however this decision goes, it's not going to put this issue to rest.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks for joining me on the program today.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on the next podcast from CCC, for everyone who cares about books and reading, record sales are a cause for celebration. According to Kristen McLean of the NPD Books Group, 2021 was the highest sales year on record for print. Indeed, McLean has given out her report card on last year's U.S. trade book sales, and it should make very happy reading for booksellers and publishers. After all, the grade she's given the industry, A++.
So the plus plus is really the fact that we had a growth year in 2020 and then another growth year in 2021. So we basically have had two growth years during the pandemic, and we're about 19% above where we were in 2019 in terms of the amount of books that are going out the door. So that's really exceptional in an industry that typically might have 2 or 3% growth in a given year. So it's really, it's unprecedented for what we've seen in the time that we've been tracking the sales, which is starting in 2004.
Book sales report card coming on the next CCC podcast. Our producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burrist Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts, and please do follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening. Join us again soon for another Velocity of Content podcast from CCC.